Okay. So in my first lecture, I was basically discussing the theory of symmetric products. And yesterday, I was kind of studying super young Mill theory. And this can't be a coincidence. So we went to Thundercast letters. Using this idea of flowing along the renormalization group. And today I actually want to discuss in which sense we can go the opposite way and kind of see how we can reach the super young Mill theory in terms of these symmetric products. So a little bit more better picture was that there is a one-parameter family of theories, so labeled by the Young-Mills coupling constant, which I remind you was basically 1 over the string coupling constant, which went to infinity. So it's a very strong coupling. We had the symmetric product, and the perturbative Young-Mills would reside in this area, which is a very strong string coupling. So here we have the sigma model on the symmetric space, the nth symmetric product of R8. And 8 was the special dimension that came out from the usual superstring. And another way to see is that it was that this is 1 plus 1 dimensional reduction is the maximum number of supersymmetries. And when we went from 10 dimensions to 2 dimensions, we had 8 scalar fields, the components of the connection, say, in the compactify direction, and this built is R8. So I think the most important part what we learned from this orbifold sigma model is that there were natural superselection sectors labeled by partitions of n. So we had partitions of n. And there was an accompanying picture for that in terms of the holonomies of these, say, the eigenvalues, or at least these coordinates living on the symmetric product. And we could have these so-called long strings, where here we had n1 up to ns eigenvalues. So the number of constituents of the partition is actually the number of strings. And the fact that we have these superselection labels labeled by partitions actually tell you that you are dealing with a free second quantized theory, which indeed we then were able to identify with the usual free superstring. Now, the fact that we had these superselection sectors was because we had the condition that the scalar fields, the 8 scalar fields, were commuting matrices. And so they had, say, joint eigenstates. They could be simultaneously diagonalized. And it's actually the flow of these eigenstates on which the symmetric group on n elements acts, which we have depicted here. Now, so in general, our Hilbert space will be the sum over all the possible superselection sectors. And the fact that it's a free theory is precisely this property, that they are superselection sectors. That is to say that if you consider the theory in a certain sector and have the Hamiltonian evolve it, it will not change. So the number of strings is preserved, which is the signature of a free theory. So the number of strings, they can't join and split. So for instance, in the very simplest case, suppose that we put n equals to 2, then there are two possible sectors. This is the space which I indicate H11 and H2. So this is the case where we have, say, trivial monotomy. And we have two short strings, both of length 1. And here we have non-trivial holonomy in, say, S2. And this actually constitutes, say, 2 strings. And this is 1 string of length 2. Now, there's also the issue of, remember, this was a gauge theory, so we could see what is the unbroken gauge group. So we start in this theory, would be a theory where you start with the gauge group U2. But since here, this is, of course, the simplest picture here, we have clearly the two eigenvalues. So we have a diagonal matrix with two eigenvalues that are different. And so here, the symmetry is broken to U1 cross U1. Whereas here, it's slightly more subtle, because usually you think of the scalar fields taking fixed constant values, but here it's definitely, of course, not concept. So actually this U1 cross U1 is even further broken down to one copy of U1. So the rank of the gauge group can be less than n. Actually, in this general case, when you have S strings, the unbroken gauge group will be U1 to the S, S being smaller or equal than n. Which is just a statement, even though we have strings moving on an n-symmetric product, the number of strings can be less than n. We can have even one string if we have the maximal, say, cycle of length n, capital N. So now, what I want to do now is that look at processes which are intrinsically non-perturbative in the super-Yang-Mills theory. So, you can now imagine that you have processes. Say, well, here's our world sheet. So all these strings have shared the same world sheet. It's a 1+1-dimensional theory. So here is the Minkowski cylinder on which the super-Yang-Mills theory lives, the 1+1-dimensional super-Yang-Mills theory. And now we can think of processes where, say, here we have an instate, and we take the instate to lie in this Hilbert space H11. So that means that you can think of, we start with an instate where we have two strings. It's a simple example. And here we put another asymptotic state, say, the out state, we put an H2. So here we have one long string. So clearly this process is zero when we are at infinite coupling in the superconformal field theory. But when the coupling is not infinite, there is a chance that you have a non-zero amplitude for this. Remember, then these are no longer super selection factors. So what I want to argue that then what typically happens is the following. You could have a process, we can have the following process, that we have the eigenvalues. So here we have the situation, say, if I draw here the picture of the eigenvalues, which are like this, and here they are like this, and it could be an intermediate process where the eigenvalues actually touch. The moment they touch actually means geometrically, if you just picture what this string is, it's actually kind of a figure eight. So I want to argue that there can be processes like this happening in the Yang-Mills theory. However, so this is clearly something which, again, also if you think in terms of symmetry breaking patterns, here we have the breaking pattern U1 squared, here we have the theory with U1. Here, actually, when the two eigenvalues coincide, there's a bigger group which is unbroken. So here we have actually a phase of the theory where there's a U2 symmetry group. So we want to argue that somehow the theory at very strong coupling is typically, say, can be treated as a superconformal field theory in and out regions. But here is some kind of area where actually you really have the non-abelian gauge symmetry. This is the qualitative picture. Well, right, so we have two eigenvalues, and we know there is a mass for the off-diagonal components of the gauge field, which is like this. And at this particular point, it's a point both in space and in time, at least in this description, the mass of this off diagonal, say these W bosons will be zero, and so they will typically we have to take them into account in the path integral.
Then I'm confused by the picture. I thought that the brains actually bend in and join.
Yes, of course. So
the distance between the brains.
You mean like this?
Yeah, something like.
Well, that's of course the infinitesimal description. They bend in and then they. No, these are not. These are just my boundary conditions, right?
Zero
and pi, 2 pi. They're not attached to anything. You just glue these two ends together. Yeah, yeah. So it's just this picture over here. And of course, it's all the eigenvalues that there's some sum over I here. They really have to coincide, say, in R8. So this is kind of the qualitative picture. You might imagine that such a process might appear, so that, but then the description is probably very complicated, because how do we treat the theory here? But now the approach is that the following, that we want to, so this is the description where we somewhere in the middle in this moduli space, but now we want to describe not the generic point, but now we want to concentrate in the neighborhood of the superconformal field theory. So actually what we want to do is want to do the simplest possible thing. Think of the first order variation coming out of this superconformal point. So you think of the tangent space here, and we're trying to describe tangent space in this particular direction. So it's actually something which is pretty dangerous to do in physical theories. Remember, the realization group brings you to lower energies. So the natural flow is like here, and somehow you are integrating out degrees of freedom and kind of forgetting information. So flowing up, the question is whether it's even well defined. And actually there are various problems if you go beyond first order variations, because the second order variation is not completely fixed. And so I will now just constrain myself to the first order variation, trying to see what can be the object that describes this. A nice thing is actually that such an object will be a local operator. The intuition scan the following. This will be the typical field configuration we expect for, so here we still have the Young-Mills coupling constant big, but it's not infinity. And we know now we take a configuration like this, and now we take this configuration and flow to the infrared, so we make this this syllable very, very big. Sorry? I didn't make any. Well, I said it's a complicated issue whether there will be other operate. Well, I will say a few things at the end, but let me now just do the first order variation first. So we have this local area in this two-dimensional space-time where we have a non-abelian description, but now we think of this as looking at it from a large distance. And then this area, which is should somehow be controlled by the strength of the Young-Mills coupling constant, would become smaller and smaller and smaller because we take the infinite volume limit. So in the limit where we send the Young-Mills coupling constant to infinity, we really are expecting to get a picture where there is, say, a local operator, O, sitting at a particular point on this two-dimensional space-time. And the corresponding field configurations of the X-field would be precisely as I've drawn here, would be like this, and this point here, which is the interaction point of the string, would then be corresponding to this point O. So this is the way in which we want to get string perturbation theory back, somehow by including local operators in the superconformal field theory. As David was remarking yesterday, this has very little to do with Young-Mills. It has everything to do with the symmetric product. And but it's basically the only way at this point that one can proceed in a kind of exact way. So the idea is now the following. That so we have this local operator O, and we know a few things about it, but we really would like to see, but I want to derive this, that this local operator OX is a map which roughly, say, in the case if you have n equals 2, maps H11 to H2, and vice versa. So really describes the joining and splitting of strings. And the claim, we will identify the operator in a moment and check that it indeed has that property. And then the general picture, which I want to draw first, is then the following, that we somehow want to describe, say, some kind of an effective action, actually, I think the best thought of the super Young-Mills theory. So an equivalent description of the same Young-Mills theory, not with connection, but in terms of the conformal field theory, as the action of the superconformal field theory, plus a perturbation, say, with some parameter, let me call it epsilon for the moment, times this extra operator O, say, of sigma and tau. And of course, we want to see that this epsilon actually is 1 over the Young-Mills coupling constant, that is, at least, that it's proportional to it, which was the string coupling constant. So the operator O you should think of in terms of this moduli space of field theory. So here we have the massless theory, say the superconformal field theory, where here we have the tangent space and here we have the tangent vector. And in a tangent vector to a moduli space of field theories is by itself, again, if you think about it just as a variation of the Lagrangian, is some kind of a local object. So we think of the operator O as being lying in the tangent space to this moduli space at the superconformal point. Now, the way, in this way, you make contact with the usual. So again, we want to think of O actually somehow as being DD GS. Right. No, sure. I mean, there's a much bigger space of tangent vectors, but we're trying to point out a particular direction that corresponds to superangular theory. Well, there are many, many operators that I could write down here in the conformal. Right. Well, that's then the definition of this operator O, which was. Yes. Yes. But if you think of the space of all operators, it's of course much bigger. That's just the thing that you were remarking. So we say in a moment what the properties are that would fix O, just in this abstract way. But the picture that arises, which I think is a very pretty picture, is that somehow we want to think about the super-Yang-Mill theory, but really in the not in the usual perturbative way in which you perturb in the coupling constant, but now you want to write this kind of as a perturbation theory in 1 over the coupling constant. And you think of it as an expectation value of this operator O evaluated in the superconformal field theory. Where this would be under big quotation marks, because it's not quite clear what other terms you are. Right. But so... at least there would be, but you do want to see this operator appearing in the action. I would say it will be exponentiated. And then you somehow hope that this thing has an asymptotic expansion in powers of G string, which is 1 over Yang-Mills, times some objects AN. And the objects AN are just the field configurations, so you think of these again in terms of the superconformal field theory as field configurations where you have a number of these operators O inserted. And remember, the operators O give basically a joining splitting effect on the strings. So then you can draw a picture which looks something like this, for instance, where you have, in this case, oh, I'm not drawing it very carefully. But you have, say, several points. You have, in this case, 4 interactions. So here we have 2 strings joining. And then here there's another one, here's another one, and here's another one. So the Riemann surfaces of perturbative string theory then arise as branch covers of this symmetric product. That is kind of the picture in which we want to think, at least, of perturbing the superconformal field theory, and then we hope to identify this perturbation with the Yang-Mill theory, argue that this is the picture that arises from the super-Yang-Mills model. So now the question is, and now you see that because you're allowing, so of course, if you started to think about the symmetric product, it was already an N-sheeted cover of the cylinder, but now including the twist field, you see that actually this cover may be branched. Of course, these are all kind of simple branch points where 2 eigenvalues coincide. You can think about what higher order branch points, how they appear, what their role is. And actually, they very naturally appear in the theory. Now, no. So it's, well, actually, you can, so we have maps, say X is a map, if you wish, from this world sheet sigma into R8 times N, right? Because we have N copies of R8. At least the individual, well, if you take the individual eigenvalues. And so you think of them as n of these strings, which are these objects over here. So you always should think of this picture as lying in R8. So it's not a classical branch cover where you map, say, into C, but you map it to C4. And actually, it's but that's a slightly different story. You can think of are the kind of classical configurations which are kind of minimizing the action somehow. And it would typically have, of course, holomorphic maps would be the appropriate thing. So in some sense, you can really think of this as worldsheet instantons somehow. Usually, worldsheet instantons are holomorphic maps into spacetime, which doesn't allow branch points. But somehow here, we also take into account these branch points. We just allow them. And then can we produce higher genus surfaces? Now you can ask, what is the is there an intrinsic definition of this operator O? Obtained here. And so the definition is actually the following. So O is, first of all, it's an operator in the superconformal field theory. So and if you wish, you can also think in the usual correspondence between operators and states as a state into the in the Hilbert space. And it should be of, we are interesting, the operator of least dimension, so smallest values of h and h bar, which at least satisfies the following properties. It should be SO8 invariant. Remember, the Super-Yang-Mills theory has an SO8 symmetry relating these 8 matrices. And that's a property we definitely want to preserve under the deformation. And of course, what we also want is that we, the other thing that we know, so this is the R symmetry of the gauge theory, not the gauge group. And the other thing we know is that there's this N, say, 8-8 worldsheet supersymmetry. So that's the things I want to, you want to come impose on the operator. And then actually what we want to conclude is that this coupling constant that will sit in front of the operator is actually the Yang-Mills coupling constant. And in order to do that, we have to realize the following, that in order of epsilon to be 1 over the, so we have to realize that the coupling constant in Yang-Mills theory is not a constant, but it actually has a length scale. Actually, the coupling constant has dimension 1 over length. So the coupling constant of G Yang-Mills was 1 over length. And since the whole thing, of course, so just looking at the expression, you can read off. So if epsilon was 1 over G Yang-Mills, which we want to kind of show, then you see that the dimension of the operator O should be 3. So, if you wish, should behave like a 3 form or a weight, something of weight 3. Because then combined with the integral d squared sigma and the extra 1 over length sitting in front of it, the whole thing should be dimensionless. But we want, of course. So, this is a problem you can just pose in the superconformal field theory. And now I just want to check, indeed, that this is the thing that comes out. That this thing indeed has dimension 3. So, there is intuitively clear what we want of this operator, because, as I said, we want an operator that maps, say, the sector in the Hilbert space with two strings, or at least two eigenvalues that are not twisted into one which it is twisted. So that means actually that there is an appropriate candidate for this operator, which is the twist field operator in the conformal field theory. So we're looking for an operator O, which has the property that maps H11 into H2. So we can just think in terms of these two eigenvalues. So it interchanges, say, the eigenvalue X1 and X2. And for our consideration, that means that we can just deal with the sigma model on the second symmetric space, which are these two eigenvalues. So we just want to analyze the conformal field theory that corresponds to that. Now, say just for the mathematicians, we know that if you have a conformal field theory, there's kind of this vertex algebra sitting behind it, actually somehow a non-holomorphic version of the vertex algebra, where any state in the Hilbert space corresponds to a local field, say ZZ bar, which is an operator acting on this Hilbert space. And so we can think about either about states or operators. It's the same classification. There's a one-to-one correspondence. And so we are interested now in the signal model on this second symmetric product. And we know that the Hilbert space will decompose in these two sectors, which I now kind of label slightly different. This is the sector, well, I can still label them. This kind of a sector which is untwisted, where I give Z plus, and we have always have to take the Z2 invariant piece, and then there's a piece H minus, and also there we have to take the Z2 invariant piece. Now, the operator we are looking for are the ground states in this sector H minus, because they are they have the property that they will map, say, map H plus into H minus and vice versa, and the ground state is the operator with the least dimension. So it's a small theorem, small result, that the ground states, let me just try to derive it. So this is actually true for general manifold X. The ground states of the space H minus have a conformal dimension H equals H bar equals D over 4, where we think of D, we want to this, of course, as a super conformal sigma model. So we better have a Calabi-Yau manifold. And D here is now the complex dimension of X. And, of course, the ground states are also degenerate. Actually, that's something I discussed in my first lecture. So there's a degeneracy, which is, of course, just the dimension of the homology of X. So let me call that number N. So this I just want to show why this is the case. And actually, you can show it quite easily using some tricks from conformal field theory by computing the partition function. So let's do the computation. So let's compute the partition function of this second symmetric product. So it has this general structure of any orbifold that it will be a sum over sectors. Precisely as when I discussed this orbifold Euler character, where we indicate them in this way. So there are four different sectors. And, of course, this partition function... So let me say a few things about these four different sectors, and then we see easily how we compute. So first there's the untwisted sector. The untwisted sector is just the partition function on X cross X. We didn't divide out by Z2 yet. So its partition function... is just, say, the partition function of X. So here, of course, this is always will be the trace of Q to the L naught and other stuff, where Q is e to the 2 pi I tau. And the thing is a modular invariant object. So this is just the trace of the partition function of X squared. In the end I will, but I also want to go then to other spaces. So that's why I'm doing the computation more general. So we can write it like this. And so let's introduce the notation Z for just the partition function of one copy of X. And so since this is trace of Q to the L naught minus D over 8, this is the thing we have been discussing in the first lecture. We know that it starts off the CO's expansion. Well, first of all, the ground states have precisely dimension D over 8. And there were precisely M of these ground states, where M is this dimension of the cohomology. That's something that we used for the general sigma model X. So now we also have the sector minus plus. So how do we think about this? Well, this is not just a trace of one. This is the trace of the non-trivial element in the Z2 acting on the two copies. So what are these? These will just interchange the states of the first copy with the second copy. And the trace will only contribute when these two states are the same. But then it means that the conformal dimension is just the conformal dimension of the first copy equals the one of the second. So all the conformal dimensions, it's precisely the partition function of one copy. However, all the conformal dimensions are twice as big because they get contribution of two. So this is just Z of 2 tau. And now the final thing we need is that we now want to compute this partition function, which is the twisted sector, and just computing the trace of it. But you can go from there to there by applying a tau through minus 1 over tau transformation. So this is actually z, to be precise, of tau over 2. These are kind of standard manipulations in conformal field theory. But now I can just make the Q expansion. And I see that this will go, well, I see two things. First, I see it's just comparing here that this also will start with m plus dot dot dot. But on the other hand, I know this is also the trace in this Hilbert space H minus of Q to the L naught minus, and now not D over 8, but D over 4, because we are now in a second model which has twice the dimension. So I see two things. I see that the number of ground states in this sector is m, and also see that their conformal dimension is D over 4. So that's an easy way to derive it. So here we see that the conformal dimensions are D over 4. So let's now be a little bit more precise of what these operators are. So now we take X to be R8. And then, of course, this degeneracy is just, well, it's just the dimension of exterior algebra on R8. But, of course, it also carries an SO8 action. Here, I just discussed the general signal model. So in R8, we have, of course, this special group SO8 acting. So we can even discuss how the ground states transform under the SO8. And that's a standard thing in string theory. I think Greg explained it, at least in the covariant formalism. But actually, that space splits in the following way in representations of SO8. So these are the three different eight-dimensional representations, the vector, the spinner, and the conjugate spinner. So for the 2A theory, this is the way in which this the space of dimension 2 to the 8 decomposes in SO8 representations. Well, okay, so strictly speaking, this is all true for sigma models on a compact space, so perhaps I should have taken T8. Perhaps I should have done that in order to map with these results. And actually, the other cases I will typically work with compact spaces, so we could have. But of course, then we don't have this SO8 anymore. But so this is the way in which the ground states... It's good to so the one way, okay, this is the way the ground states represent under transform under the SO8, and so now we have seen at least identified the possible states that appear as ground states in this theory. They have conformal dimensions, as I said, d over 4, so that means that actually h equals h bar, d was the complex dimension, is 1 in this case, the ground states of conformal dimension 1. So these can't be the right one. And one way to see this actually is that, of course, they all transform in these representations of SO8. So we have to do two things. We have to now make an operator which is a singlet under SO8 and also an operator which is a singlet, say, under the supersymmetry transformations. At least preserves the supersymmetry. And actually, then if you follow construction, that is actually a unique solution. And the unique solution is the following. So first there are these ground states, which I label as sigma ij, which sits in the piece, which is actually the vector times the vector. In usual superstring theory, these would be the states that build up the metric and the B field. So they transform as a two tensor under this SO8 group. And but that's not enough. So in order to make a state which is supersymmetric invariant, we take the field X, the usual coordinate field X, which actually in this sector has a series expansion in terms of half integers. So it has an expansion of the following form, sorry, alpha n z to the minus n minus 1. And then the operator O that is the candidate for this deformation is this operator, where we act with the operators I'm a minus 1/2, a minus alpha minus 1/2 on this operator O here. Now, acting with these fields which have, say, conformal dimension 1/2 means that the total conformal dimensions of this operator O are 1 plus 1/2, so 3/2, left and right moving dimension, total dimension 3. And also you can check that it has nice properties on the supersymmetry operators. I actually won't go through the detail of the algebra, but if you see how the supercharges act on this operator O, because we have actually acting with these alphas upon them, you can use some algebra to rewrite this as a DDZ of some other operator, the O prime. Well, part of course, these are also the Wilczek superchargers. These are the unbroken spacetime superchargers, which preserve at least generators. Yes, yes. So they generate the 16 charges that are unbroken. So this operator actually, you can then check, because you can look in the other sectors of the theory. Of course, here we had only a Z2 second symmetric product, but if you go to higher order, symmetric products are twist fields of higher order, but all their conformal dimensions are higher, and you can't construct, so they are not the least irrelevant operator, not the operator with the least conformal dimension. So this operator O is actually, yeah, there's a formula. On say the I think it's well actually I think it's n minus one. Right. That's of course that's the way to do it. You just have these fields over here, the real ground states, they can just add up. So Z3 twist fields would have conformal dimension 2, and then you act with alpha minus 1/2, you find 5/2 for the compact term. Right. Well, it's a separate story, but it definitely has conformal dimensions bigger than 3. So it does have these properties, and actually it has a few even nicer properties, because of course there's one thing that we have, there's another supersymmetry in the Super-Yang-Mills theory, which was the so-called broken supersymmetry, which was the constant shift of the thetas. Remember that we also had a transformation where we just say, have the xi's, which are now matrices, being 0, and these went to some constants. And these were the 16 broken supersymmetries. But that's quite obvious why these don't, because what is this theta? Actually, if you look what the generator is for that operator, it's something like the trace. So theta is now a matrix. Theta I, they come from the sigma. So this is the, say, the charge for the broken supercharges. And in terms of the eigenvalues, this is, of course, the sum then of these theta. But now we recognize the following, that in this, what we have been doing here, and also this field X here, is, of course, the field X on which is the, say, the thing which is odd under the Z2 transformation. So what in the case of the second symmetric product, you can think of this as being x times, say, x mod Z2. So these are just the eigenvalues. You think about... So in the case, if you take the second symmetric product of R8, you can think of this just being R8 times, say, R8 mod Z2. And then here we have, say, the coordinate x1 plus x2, and here the coordinate x1 minus x2. And all we have been doing was something to looking in this particular sector of the theory. So this sector is just a copy of a sigma model R8, and it doesn't really see anything of this operator O. And also the corresponding fermion is the fermion that sits here. So it's completely clear that also this one will respect that operator O. It's actually strictly zero, and not a total derivative, as for the other operator. Right, so the really surprising thing when we're doing this is that actually there's even much more powerful statement. We know that this symmetric product description, which is the usual description of free superstrings, not only has an SO8 symmetry, but has this Poincaré symmetry in 10 dimensions, but it's realized non-linearly. But actually can show that this operator O is actually equal to the usual so-called Mandelstam vertex of superstring perturbation theory, which the precise form of it was fixed by Mandelstam by indeed requiring that there is SO91 invariant. However, this is not really a check that this is the deformation direction of Young-Mills, because nobody knows the proof that the same property holds for the Young-Mills theory. That is a nonlinear realized 10-dimensional Lorentz group. So it's true for the, say, the free theory, and it's true for this operator O. So it's, you almost reverse the argument to say that since O is at least the first order deformation in the direction of Young-Mills, this suggests that also the Young-Mills theory is somehow probably acquires this 10-dimensional Lorentz group. Yeah, he wrote it slightly different, but so you, it's quite, well, it's actually quite beautiful the way that works, because he actually used, of course, the NSR formalism. And he had a picture, well, of course, the same picture of, first of all, having this topology of the surface. And that means actually, this, of course, since this is really the topology, it has only has to do with the field X of sigma and tau. So you would write this just as being, say, the bosonic twist field. And then he actually took the picture changing operator acting upon this. So he was in the NSR formalism, so he had something like dxi psi I acting on this operator sigma. But actually psi I is precisely, say, this operator sigma I. In the Green-Schwarz formalism, what the Neuwirth-Schwarz fermions are, actually they become, of course, now spin fields. So it's actually dx on this spin field acting on the bosonic twist field. And so sigma I with the small sigma built up the total supersymmetric C2 twist field. And then dxi is actually this operator alpha minus 1/2 that act upon it. So that fixes it completely.
But you haven't taken any larger limits.
No.
N equals 2.
Yes.
So you're claiming or suggesting that SU2 Young-Mills in 1 plus 1 dimension has 10 dimensional comprehension?
Well, no, it's not that comprehension.
Well, okay, so in order to make contact, I have to take n to infinity in order to make contact with the usual Mandelstam vertex, of course. No, but I mean, in order to map his computation to this computation, you really have to map the two computations to each other. That only happens if you take the large n limit, because otherwise the algebra looks very different. Well, he is actually working, of course, on this world sheet. And this is some kind of an n-fold cover of the thing that we're starting off here. I mean, I think it's not completely obvious. I don't really think that this correspondence will work. If you don't take it. Sorry, that the operators are the same.
Yeah, but if he was doing his calculation on the theory, I don't know.
That's what I'm saying. You still have something bigger than SLA. You have to try to Galilean.
Yes, yes.
And so
well, that Lie algebra is, of course, slightly. Yes. Yes. Okay. It's a good point. So it's some contraction of that other algebra. So. Yes. Yes. Right. But I actually never actually looked into the details. That's actually quite an interesting point to see how the computation would match, because it definitely has to differ. As you say, it is certainly not clear that it has this 10-dimensional Lorentz symmetry. Yeah, so that way you make contact with the usual interaction vertex. Just as a little aside, let me say a few words about what happens if you go to other dimensions. And this is actually not really physical, it's more, I think, mathematical, but than 8. I mean, because there is this. Yes, I'll come back to it, yeah? No, just ask me. Oh, you mean with the higher order terms? Oh, no, then we better prepare. Yes. So as a kind of a mathematical interlude, you can ask, what happens if you, for the general symmetric model, so if you have this nth symmetric model on X, which is always a superconformal field theory, at least if X is a Calabi-Yau manifold, what happens if you perturb it by this Z2 twist field? Or the analog of the Z2 twist field omega, O, which somehow has the property that describes the joining and splitting of strings. So the question is whether this picture in eight transverse dimensions can be useful to describe interacting strings or theories in higher dimensions or lower dimensions. Now again, if the complex dimension, we saw that the complex dimension of X is that D, that this operator O, constructed in this way, will have dimension 1 plus D over 4, the total dimension, which for D equals 4, so R8 gave... I want to have D over 2. What do I want? Yes. Of course, the total dimension was this. And here we see something interesting, that if we choose D equals 2, so go to the case where we have an, say, Calabi-Yau surface, or a real four-dimensional space, that this dimension actually, so the dimension of O, in that case, so for D equals 2, this will be 2. Or more precise, it will be 1, 1. And that's actually quite interesting because it suggests a very different picture. It suggests actually that the operator, at least the first order, preserves the conformal symmetry of the theory. So now we have a conformal field theory, and we have a perturbation, which again will describe joining and splitting of strings, but now actually it will move us somehow in the space of superconformal field theories. Sorry? Yeah, well, I just described now what this... Yeah, it is because actually this... well, let me say... So we have actually a marginal operator. And it's actually, I think, quite a beautiful... There's a beautiful geometric picture which goes along with it, but I don't really know what it means, but... No. Well, you could think about this as would be Yang-Mills theory, at least a dimensional reduction of, well, actually of six-dimensional Yang-Mills. It would be n equals 4, 4. But these are theories with 4 and 4 supersymmetries. Yeah. But it's not a conformal field theory. So it can't be the perturbation of Yang-Mills, but you can just still ask what does it mean. Now, there are several facts, actually. Actually, one way to think about geometrically about this operator O is the following. We have this space R8 mod Z2, and you could ask, is there an operator which blows up this singularity? Just as a usual orbifold, as we do orbifolds. And actually, this computation, which tells you that the conformal dimension is 3 and not 2, tells you there's no geometric way to blow up that singularity. Which is something, I guess, the algebraic geometers know already. But, so C form of Z2, you can't blow it up. But actually, if you do it in four two complex dimensions, you can do this. And it's the usual C2 singularities, for instance, that you have if you describe K3 as an orbifold of the four torus. So that's strongly related with this. So there are two facts which are nice if you work in two complex dimensions. So first of all, that there are natural desingularizations of the symmetric products. This is the so-called Hilbert scheme, which you can think about in many ways. But one way to think about it, that it's somehow the moduli space. Well, strictly speaking, you can think about it as a moduli space of rank 1, torsion-free coherent sheaves, with C2, so instanton number n. So another way to think about this is it's a kind of U1 instantons with instanton number n. And of course, these should necessarily be point-like. But that is would be giving you a description in terms of this n-symmetric product, which are just n points on X. But this can be nicely kind of decompactified by also including sheaves. And then you have the Hilbert scheme. Now, these objects were introduced quite a time ago in the context, say, of Calabi-Yau manifolds by Bovill as a very nice example of constructing higher-dimensional Calabi-Yau spaces because you can show that these are smooth. So this is a smooth space. And actually, the things that we were computing in the first lecture, like these Euler numbers, were originally computed by Goetsche for these Hilbert schemes. So there's a kind of theorem there which tells you that the cohomology of this Hilbert scheme and of the orbifold cohomology of the symmetric product are the same. So that's one picture that you have. So here you can actually think about these spaces also in terms of a smooth Calabi-Yau. Not quite clear for me, because it's not, there's not kind of a nice deformation parameter which deforms the symmetric product to the Hilbert scheme. It's actually quite a drastic thing to do. So it just shows you that perhaps somehow this orbifold prescription isn't. Well, this actually, I think, perhaps I come to the following thing, which I also not quite well understand. Because suppose now you think about either the symmetric product or this Hilbert scheme, you can think about it, well, as a Calabi-Yau. And you can just count how many moduli this Calabi-Yau has. Now, there's an obvious, so X is here always a Calabi-Yau manifold, so it is K3, or it's an abelian surface, 4 torus. And now, if you compute the moduli, say the number of moduli of the symmetric product, so you certainly get, of course, the number of moduli of X. You can just vary X, but actually, it's plus 1. Complex moduli, say. And the same story is true for the Kähler moduli. And actually, one way to understand this is if you just compute the first order variation, and it's actually just a kind of a mathematical reflection of the same computation I was doing here using the language of orbifolds conformal field theories. You see, in the end, what you have to compute is roughly H11 of the symmetric product. And then you see quite easy using the formulas we have been describing in the first lecture, that this is the same thing as the number of moduli of X. But then there's also, I write it like this, 0, 0, of the kind of second copy of X. Remember that in this symmetric product are all these copies of X appearing as the second and the third and the fourth diagonal. And they contributed, say, to the orbifold cohomology, which is the same thing as the usual cohomology of these Hilbert schemes, if you want to think about it in that way. But they were shifted in degree. They were shifted in degree by n if you take the nth copy. So the second copy, this is the small diagonal. So where 2 points coincide. And it's, you see that it contributes to the number of moduli. So we see that we get actually the following picture. So this is kind of, if you wish, the space of Calabi-Yaus, the complex moduli of the Calabi-Yaus. And so here we have, say, well, there's actually two pictures. There's a picture of the Hilbert scheme, where you think of really as smooth Calabi-Yau spaces. And there's the similar picture where we think in terms of the orbifold. So there's a kind of a natural projection from here to here. But there's one extra, so there are, say, for K3, it would be 20 complex dimensions here. But there's one extra dimension, which is corresponds to turning on this operator O. Now, this is something which I have been explained to me. I don't really understand it. But actually, what I think what happens is the following, that there is a projection from this space to this space. But as soon as you are outside this space, the two things are actually identical. Or strictly speaking, this is a projection which is generically 2 to 1. So you have 2 points here being mapped, say, to 1 point over here. But that's both default. Yeah, the moduli space of this considered as a Calabi-Yau manifold or orbifold. So there's an extra parameter which just deforms this space to another space. And it's a perfectly fine target space for a Calabi-Yau. And you can see it somehow as a deformation by adding this twist field. So this kind of suggests that you can think about sort of the interacting string theory a string moving on, say, this some manifold Y, which is of complex dimension 2n, but has no longer any relation with the symmetric product.
So it's 2 to 1 outside.
Yeah.
Even for general n.
Yes. I'm not quite sure what that means.
N equals 2, we
understand how the law. Yes. But I think for general n, this is this map is 2 to 1.
General.
Yeah. At least I think that's what I understood from the literature.
The divisor of the
this?
Yeah,
So this is the space of Hilbert schemes, or the space of symmetric products.
Oh, so then what's the bigger?
It's the space of Calabi-Yau manifolds. The complex structure, say. So it's the one bigger. It's a 21-dimensional space in which there's a 20-dimensional space of symmetric products of Calabi-Yau, which are kind of the free strings. And there's an extra parameter, which is kind of the interaction. Well, actually down here, because I was using this orbifold language. I can't really... Well, I think what it actually does, it blows up this... So you have to see what this operator O does, and you can trace it back where it comes from. So it's actually somehow the fundamental class of this diagonal. I think what you're actually doing is kind of blowing up this diagonal, but I'm not quite sure whether that is the right picture. The nice thing is that since you're here in the context of deformation spaces of Calabi-Yau, you do know that it's integrable and that you can kind of exponentiate it to a finite distance. So there's really a nice smooth space here. And somehow that's the same thing what we want also for, of course, in eight dimensions. But unfortunately there we know that there's no longer a sigma model. It's the effective theory of a Yang-Mills theory. But in this case, somehow the deformation really keeps you in the space of sigma models. So somehow you would like to understand these general manifolds here as appearing as maps, branch covers into the space X itself. One other just kind of a remark about it's more kind of advertising the philosophy than actually giving any kind of rigorous things. I mean, there's also a way in which you can think now about, say, quantum cohomology. So this is also a very simple remark. So usually you say, well, there's some Hilbert space, let's call it H1 for being one copy of the string, which is something like the ring of differential form. So think about the topological sigma model for the moment, not the real sigma model. And then what is quantum cohomology? Well, you look at these strings which are joining and splitting, and you put in two states and outcomes something like alpha wedge beta, possibly with quantum corrections. Now, how does the same story look from this perspective? Well, now we don't have the sigma model on X, but we have the sigma model, say, on the symmetric product of X, or, if you wish, on general, M symmetric product of X. And then we know that the Hilbert space will split in two pieces. We have this H11, and we have an H2. So now I have actually a slightly different picture that goes along, because this is still a two-dimensional sigma model, but now I still have the topology of a cylinder. So I'm not actually going to do Riemann surfaces. I always take this topology, always is the cylinder. And now here I have an instate. Say I put the instate in H11. So you could think about an instate being something like alpha tensor beta. Then here is the outstate. And I want to have that to be an H2. And now here I do an insertion by the operator O. So the operator O kind of corresponds, is the kind of algebraic realization of the joining and splitting of strings. So this algebraic operation, taking the wedge product, is kind of performed by including the operator O. But we know what it kind of does, because what it does, we know it's kind of dual to this small diagonal in the symmetric product. So what it does, it takes this thing, which lives, say, in X cross X, and then it restricts it to the diagonal. But that's kind of the definition of alpha wedge beta. So you see that this is the same way of doing the operation over here, but it's kind of the algebraic operation now corresponds to an operator in the conformal field theory. And of course now you can have operators, which I'll probably tell a little bit more out tomorrow, operators which are not just these Z2 twist fields, but you can have multilinear operators all be realized by conformal field theory states. Okay, so this was just a few mathematical remarks. And now we should go on with the story. And so I return to this general picture that we have. So we have super young Mills in 1 plus 1. We have the coupling constant. And we have these two fixed points. So here we have the infrared fixed points, and here we have the ultraviolet fixed points. Now, again, you can think about it as just putting young Mills on the cylinder, say a cylinder of a certain radius, R, and make this radius big or small. So if you take the radius very big, you're actually doing the conformal field theory, which is over here. We could also ask what happens if you make the radius very small. Now, that actually is better to look at the theory from this way. And you say, well, that is what we know, that's just the dimensional reduction of super young Mills. So here, we somehow expect to find 0 plus 1 dimensional super young Mills. And that actually I could have taken also as my starting point. Actually, that is the usual conventional starting point of matrix theory. And so this is not a conventional lecture series about matrix theory. It's not supposed to be. But right now I want to say a few words about the 0 plus 1 dimensional super young Mills. And actually, it's some sense you can say it's an easier model, but I think actually it's a more complicated model because it's a model that doesn't have this one parameter. And you saw that we made very good use of it because we were somehow able to describe this infinitesimal neighborhood. And at this point, we have actually no parameter to make an expansion into. Sorry? The relevant operator. Well, it's the usual first-order perturbation in G Yang Mills. But so you can do standard, try to do standard perturbation theory. But well, no, it's a little bit more subtle. Yes. Well, I'm actually, this is not a very precise picture. I was actually just meant to be a little bridge to go to quantum mechanics. I didn't want to make it much more precise. So let me now just start with this super young Mills in 0 plus 1 dimension. So this is what usually called matrix quantum mechanics. And actually, one of the things that I will be doing with this, and I think that's the interesting thing, is that there are kind of two ways in which you can think about these various super young Mills theories. And that's usually a thing which is very confusing if people first learn about matrix theory, is that the notion of compactification is kind of a bizarre one. Because it, say, there is the map which, say, maps n plus 1 dimensional, say, young Mills to young Mills theory, say, in one dimension lower, and usually you think about this as a process in which you lose a lot of information, in the sense that this theory has much fewer degrees of freedom than the one over here. However, there is another, so this is the usual, say, compactification, or dimensional reduction. However, there's another way which goes from here to here, where you basically essentially keep all the degrees of freedom, but just reformulate them in one space-time dimension lower. And that's something which we typically don't do if we think about dimensional reduction. But this is the so-called Iguchi-Kawai reduction. And one of the nice things of that reduction is that it actually allows you to go in the other direction. Somehow you can go up. And that actually we will need, because we will see that if we compactify strings on the dimension, that actually the dimension of the young Mills theory will be one more. So compactifying the string on one dimension will actually map from here to here. And that's something that, in that sense, the theory that contains all the other theories is the 0 plus 1 dimensional theory, and not, say, the 9 plus 1 dimensional theory. No, it's actually, it's really very important in this process that you allow the gauge group, the rank of the gauge group, to be infinite. So we'll see how this appears. So on the one hand, you might think indeed that the 0 plus 1 dimensional case is much simpler, but we see that we get all the other ones as special cases of the 0 plus 1 dimensional super young Mills. So what are the fields? So we have a connection which only has a time-like component. Again, the field content is just the one that you get by reducing 10-dimensional Yang-Mills to 1. And then there are 9 scalar fields. I run from 1 to 9. And so there's an SO9 group now. And then there are the fermions, theta I, which are 16 of them. And of course, all of them are n by n matrices. Now, in quantum mechanics, it doesn't really, the gauge field doesn't really play any role, so we can just kind of integrate it out. The only thing that it will do for us, so we can eliminate A naught, and the only thing that it will do for us is that it implements Gauss' law. That is that in the end, if we construct the Hilbert space of this super quantum mechanics, we want to impose UN invariants. And then you can write down Lagrangian, so I won't write anymore the gauge field. Lagrangian is something like 1 over g squared, so the Mills coupling constant. There's only in time now. And the Lagrangian looks like trace of 1 half x dot squared plus 1 quarter sum of ij xi xj for commutator squared. And then there are the fermion terms. Of course, these two terms are there because we are working with n by n matrices that disappear in the case we take n equals 1, and then you recognize this as just being the usual Lagrangians that Dan was explaining to us, which are just supersymmetric point particle. So it's a matrix version of the super point particle. And indeed, it looks like you have a coupling constant G Yang-Mills, but just by rescaling the fields, you can easily eliminate it. So it's not a theory with a coupling constant. It's just one quantum mechanics model. There's no useful perturbation that you can do. And so you can think also, let me write down the Hamiltonian for it. So so I just now put the coupling constant to 1, and the Hamiltonian is just, so the pi's are the conjugate momenta to the axis. And then, so you see there's just like three fields, three particles, and then there is a potential, which is this commutator. And also, as Dan showed, for the fermionic fields in quantum mechanics, they don't give a kinetic term. So the only thing is the potential term here, theta, comma I, xi, theta. So we want this, plus that we want to have a constraint which imposes the UN gauge invariant. Now, there are many things you can say about the model, but the only thing I want to do today is to show you indeed how the map, this map that I promised, how you go from the Yang-Mill theory, say, in 0 plus 1 dimensions to higher dimensions. So this quantum mechanical model is supposed to be an exact formulation of 11-dimensional M theory in the same way that the matrix string was supposed to be an exact formulation of the 10-dimensional superstring. So there's the usual identification with N with the total P plus momentum, and the Hamiltonian should then be the Lightwin Hamiltonian. That's the same correspondence, actually. So the question is now that suppose you want to, one thing that you can ask, what happens if you want to compactify this model? So if when we have a sigma model, we know how to compactify, because we just say, well, we have a coordinate x, and we identify it with x plus 2 pi r. So now we want to kind of do the same thing for this matrix theory, and see that indeed, in that way, you get the higher dimensional Yang-Mills theories. So if we say, take one of these coordinates, say 9, I want to show in which way you now indeed go from 0 plus 1 dimensional Yang-Mills to 1. Those one-dimensional Yang-Mills. And so what you have to ask is what happens to this equation in the matrix context. And the important thing is to realize is that these matrices are, of course, only defined up to gauge transformations. There's still this was, of course, the theme in all these things, that it's always the U and gauge symmetry that's acting here. So actually this equation gets replaced by another equation where you demand that, so these are now n by n matrices, that this will be up to some conjugation by a matrix U, or U being it is, the UN. And all the other axes will be invariant on it. Times the unit matrix, yes. So this is, if you wish, just one way to... There are various things to motivate a decision, but if you just from a mathematical point of view, this is just the condition that you want to impose. Matrices which satisfy a constraint of this type. Now, there's basically a unique solution to this. Well, so the first remark to be made is that you know that these things are very difficult to realize these kind of equations with finite matrices, because you take the trace on both sides and you find that you get a problem. So this n here should be not be finite. So better to say that, so you have these axes, all the axes operate on some Hilbert space. Let's think about it like that. And the thing is that we now want to have them act on a Hilbert space. So these are, say, endomorphisms of some Hilbert space H, and now we want to take the following ansatz for this Hilbert space. We take L2 functions on the circle. So this R is not very important, of course. We can rescale it to 1. I often put it to 1. And then times just a finite dimensional Hilbert space, say of dimension n. So this n is not the n over here, so perhaps I should give it another name, n tilde. So we really send n to infinity. And now the question is, so given this representation, can you find a simple solution for that equation? And the sorry? I'm going to give you now a u and an x that satisfy an ansatz for what u is and what the x's are that satisfy that relation. So the idea is now the following. The solution looks like this. U, you take... so I take sigma to be the coordinate on the circle. I take u just multiplication by e to the I sigma. So it, if you wish, tensor the identity on the second, acting on the second component. But you can make some also some more interesting solutions where you actually have also a non-trivial action on this part, but let me start with this. And then the operator, say, x9, let me write like this to indicate it really is a matrix. You now write as I dd sigma plus A of sigma. And the other xi's, I write them as operators. So where both the xi of sigma and A of sigma are just n tilde by n tilde matrices. And they are periodic, of course. So sigma is always living on the circle. Now, it's, you see quite easily how you realize it, because the commuting u through to this dd sigma gives you a shift by 1. Or perhaps there should be a 1 over 2 pi here, perhaps. Something like that. So this is, I think the theorem is that this is at least, certainly when this n tilde is 1, but otherwise also there's a complete understanding of what the solutions are of the condition on the left-hand side, and this is the possible solution. So now what you just have to do is to plug these fields into the Lagrangian. So of course in this, we have this trace, but it's now the trace in this Hilbert space H. But that we write as an integral d sigma over the circle times the what I say called trace tilde, which is the trace in this finite n by n space. So this is the ansatz we want to make, and the claim is that if you just plug this in the Hamiltonian that we had at some point on the blackboard, the matrix theory Hamiltonian, then we see that the super Yang-Mills 0 plus 1 now becomes super Yang-Mills in 1 plus 1. So actually allowing Yang-Mill theories with infinite gauge group, infinite rank, allow you to contain also all the higher dimensional Yang-Mill theories. And that you see that the way you go from here to here is actually compactifying one of the coordinates. And that's kind of the frame of mind you want to have. In that sense, the matrix quantum mechanics contains all the other Yang-Mill theories as long as they kind of make sense as quantum mechanical models. So we can kind of continue now and do 2 plus 1 dimensional Yang-Mills. Again, seeing this as a special case of the 1 plus 1 dimensional Yang-Mills. But of course, again, we have to make the gauge group infinite rank. So this is quite a pretty story, and which I will try to tell something about tomorrow, which give a following kind of idea. So remember, M theory should somehow kind of correspond to... So we have M theory, we have string theory, and we have, say, the super Yang-Mills description. So we see that if we just have M theory on R, say, 10,1, well, of course, there's no string theory description here. But that means just doing Yang-Mills theory in one-dimensional Yang-Mills theory. And then if you compactify this to some d-dimensional torus, say, 10 minus d, 1. In string theory, that means that you work on a d minus 1 dimensional torus. If I'm doing this correctly, yeah. And in Yang-Mills actually means that we will... No. 10 minus d, yes, of course. And here we will have this times time. So compactifications of M theory, compactifications of string theory, are actually kind of dimensional, not dimensional reductions, the inverse process, dimensional growth of the Yang-Mills theory. And so it's the question is, what are the properties that we know of these higher dimensional Yang-Mills theory? What do they tell us about the properties of string theory and in particular the properties of M theory? And one thing that we want to see, I mean, that's one side, is that particularly that the non-perturbative symmetries of string theory are becoming more transparent in this matrix formulation. So if you wish, one of the direct goals is to understand the symmetry group of non-perturbative string theory. And the symmetry group is this kind of exceptional group over the integers, which you, of course, have to define also for d less than 6. But it's kind of the obvious thing in terms of Dinkin diagrams. And actually, I will try to see show it to you tomorrow, at least in the cases where d is less than equal to 5, how indeed the properties of this Yang-Mill theory are precisely predicting certain symmetries of... I mean, it's a very nice way to understand certain symmetries, non-perturbative symmetries of the string. Another interesting thing, which we probably won't have much time to discuss, is that here we compactified in a kind of trivial way on tori, but actually there are beautiful variations using non-commutative geometry, but I think we will be hearing about that next week when Albert Schwarz will come here. So actually there are kind of variations on this theme where you don't go to super Yang-Mills theories but go to generalizations of super Yang-Mills. So there are even more. In that sense, this is really the beginning. It is not the specialization. It contains the usual Yang-Mills theories in all the other dimensions, and it includes other objects which are not conventional Yang-Mills theories. Okay, I'll stop here today.